Loralee.com has a comprehensive search engine that will help you find what you're looking for. Among the 500 hours of audio interviews and the thousands of pages, including books, articles, and lots of great information that are featured on our site. Subscribe to our free emailed newsletter and you'll receive even more news and features. Hi and welcome. I'm Loralee. This show is dedicated to those central mysteries of life. Who are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going? That's the adventure of life, and it's a big, fascinating universe out there. That's why we call this show Conversation for Exploration. What's ahead for exciting new discoveries in science as we add new tools to better understand the world around us? We'll examine one promising new field this hour, known as cymatics, C-Y-M-A-T-I-C-S, from the Greek chyma, meaning wave, for the intricate and complex wave patterns that emerge as sound waves are made visible. Joining us is acoustics engineer John Reed, whose own cymatics research revealed cymatics patterns forming hieroglyphs in the Great Pyramid and megalithic maze patterns in a Templar chapel. He's invented what he calls a cymoscope, a new device to reveal these hidden vibratory patterns. And he's here to give an overview of the field, both its 200-year-old history and a conjecture on future applications for cymatics. Hi, John, and welcome.
Thank you, Loralee.
What led you from being a pretty standard acoustics engineer to seeking, exploring the field of cymatics?
Well, my story is really it's quite an unusual one because it starts actually in around about 1922. Not that I'm that old, Loralee, but actually it starts in a little terraced house in Newcastle, which is in the north of England. And in this terraced house, around the early 1920s, my grandfather was very interested in the field of radio. And he built his own little radio sets on the circular mahogany table that he had in his parlor. And so the story goes, my father told me this story, there was a day when my grandfather had built this wonderful three-valved radio, and you have to visualize these valves glowing and pulsating. And under the table, my father, just a little boy, I think he was around about eight, was sitting on the pedestal of this table. And around the table were assembled some of the neighbors. They'd invited all the neighbors in to witness this great event, this new fangled radio that my grandfather had built.
Out of a kit, didn't
he? Yeah, out of a kit, basically, that's right. He couldn't afford a loudspeaker, so what he had on the table was an upturned pudding basin. This is like a, you know, sort of pottery basin.
Jerry Riggin of the first degree.
Yeah, exactly. And he put inside this basin a set of old headphones, which is all he could afford. And so the sort of resonance of the pudding basin amplified the sound so that everyone assembled could hear. And so the story goes that when my grandfather tuned in this radio and got the first sounds from it, it was actually a broadcaster telling the story of the opening of Tutankhamun's tomb. Now, this story later went on to illuminate how, the actual radio broadcast went on to illuminate how the various artifacts were being taken from the tomb over a long period of time. So whilst my father was growing up, you know, more and more radio broadcasts were coming out about this tomb. So my grandfather became very interested in this whole story and in Egyptology in general. And he then went on to excite my father about the same subject. But so my father actually became interested in not only in Egyptology, but also in the field of electronics, which he got from my grandfather.
It all looked like magic to you guys, didn't it?
Absolutely. You know, and so when my father grew up, he passed all that kind of information on to me. And so I became interested in the field of electronics, but also in Egyptology.
And it was on a trip to Egypt where you were looking around going, there's something going on here and I need to find out what it is, that you cast about and found cymatics as a tool to help you illuminate some hidden secrets there.
Yes, that's right. Well, my father and I were in Egypt in 1996. We were there, as many other tourists, and went into the Great Pyramid. And I, for the very first time, heard the wonderful acoustics in the Great Pyramid. And you know, after that, I was just totally hooked. I really believed that those acoustics had been designed, that they were not just an accident.
They were intentionally.
Intentionally designed, exactly. And so I decided to go back another year. I went back in 97, and this time my father couldn't go because he was actually ill at the time. But this particular year, early 97, I was there with John Anthony West, who's an American and a really good Egyptian tour guide. And John introduced the whole group to the subject of toning. This is where you make vowel sound chant rather than words per se. So you're actually simply making sounds. And this technique that he introduced to us, I then used to actually experiment with the granite box. I actually lay in the sarcophagus in the King's Chamber and made these kind of just pure vowel sounds. And what happened to me during that particular period was that the sound that I heard, I also felt in every cell of my body. It kind of washed over me like a wave. And I realized at that point that something really magical was happening in that granite box. And as you said, you know, I needed a tool to explore, to find what were the secrets of that granite box.
What sort of sound were you making in the box? Can you demonstrate?
I was making an ooh sound, just a very simple ooh. Ooh, which is a vowel sound. As I say, instead of just hearing that sound come back to me,
you were feeling
it. I felt it very powerfully. The resonance of that box was very special, obviously, and it was sort of washing me. It was like a kind of sonic bath waving up and down my body. So I knew that something special was happening, and I really needed to find a tool to explore the resonances inherent in that granite box.
So back in England, you find cymatics, not a well-known field, yet one with a very long and interesting history to it.
Yes, I was casting around, as I said, for this kind of powerful tool that could help me to explore the resonances in the granite box. I already had a whole armory of equipment, you know, analyzers, acoustic analyzers, and so on. But I came across the work of this guy, Hans Jennies, a Swiss scientist who was working in the 1960s. And he was making sound manifest or visible with various means. For example, he was sprinkling sand on membranes and exciting the membranes with sound.
You mean like a drum head?
Yeah, like a drum head for all the world. And what he was finding was that he was actually able to view the phenomena, the actual sounds themselves were manifesting on the membrane. So he was able to see the sounds in a sense. And so I looked into cymatics in some detail and realized that it was a tool that I could use on the granite box in the King's Chamber. And that's really how I got into this.
Let's describe more of what cymatics is in terms of making sound visible. You're using a mobile medium like grains of sand, and you're running tones through, say, a drum head that's easy to visualize, and these wonderful, intricate, orderly, symmetrical patterns emerge based on the tone that's vibrating this membrane, this drum head. Can you describe why that would be? Because you have lines of quiescent, lines of activity. The grains of sand find the quiet zones. They get pushed out of the active zones, and they create this intricate pattern.
It is a very strange phenomena, actually. So you have a membrane. You excite that membrane with a sound. So you can actually use your own voice. You don't have to have any electronics involved at all. But, you know, Hans Jenny used a whole series of different types of transducers, some crystal resonators, which were little pieces of piezo crystal that he used to excite steel plates, brass plates, and so on, again, that he sprinkled this sand or various types of media on. And what happens is, when you excite either a membrane or a steel plate or a brass plate or a sheet of glass, whatever it may be, the membrane kind of distorts. It actually is shaped by the sound. And what happens is you get little troughs where the sand effectively collects. So you've got areas of areas called modes. Some of these modes are antinodes, some are nodes. And the antinodes are areas where the plate or the membrane is vibrating at its greatest. And in the areas where it's not vibrating is where the sand actually collects. So in a sense, what you see is a kind of negative. It's an inverse of the sound pattern that you actually see on the membrane or the plate.
Like a reverse of a photographic image.
Yeah, very much like a negative of a photographic image.
And Jenny found that each tone had its own signature cymatics pattern. Change tones, pattern changes.
Yes, Jenny was really concerned with the phenomenology itself. He was concerned with the actual the scientific aspect of the phenomena. You know, he wasn't looking for applications. He was just actually observing very, very closely what was happening to these sand grains or these other media that he was using as they were pushed about the plate or pushed about the membrane and how they interacted. You know, if you use more than one sound, you get interference patterns between the two sounds, and he looked very closely at these kind of interference patterns. And when you are very close, when your eyes are very close to a membrane or to a plate that is vibrating with this media on, amazing things happen. You know, you see like galaxies forming, and, you know, what look like living creatures appear right before your eyes. It is a fascinating subject. And as I say, you know, to me this was an ideal tool to be able to explore the granite box in the King's Chamber.
One of the hallmarks of Jenny's work is these organic shapes that act like they're alive, and yet it's just sand jumping around. And his hallmark is these are the underlying patterns of creation. So I think this is a very profound discovery with immense applications. So I can understand why you felt cymatics would be not just a worthwhile tool to discover these hidden secrets you sensed were there in Egypt, but also cymatics has become your life work.
Absolutely, Laura Lee. Cymatics actually has huge power. I'm finding so many applications for this wonderful new science, and I really believe that in the fullness of time, cymatics will almost change the face of the planet. So important are the implications from this work.
To better understand the implications, let's look at the history, because you've done the most digging up this long and interesting history for cymatics. I also want to talk about this new device that you've invented, and you have others in the work. And I also want to hear what you found in Egypt, so lots to talk about before we get to those immense implications. Let's start with the history.
Well, the history seems to have started with Ernst Chladni. He was a German, and he was a scientist operating around about 1800, and he made a momentous discovery. I cannot really understand how he had the thought process to get to this particular point, but nevertheless, what he did was, he was a musician as well as a scientist, and he used a violin bow to play a brass plate, and on this brass plate he'd sprinkled sand. And when he did this, he saw a beautiful pattern emerge. Now, why would he do that? I really don't know. It was a kind of giant scientific leap. I certainly would never have thought of doing such a thing. But anyway, Ernst Chladni, having seen this amazing pattern, went on to really write the first chapter in the whole science of acoustics. He wrote a groundbreaking book on acoustics, introduced the whole subject to humankind.
And this was 200 years ago.
Yeah, 200 years ago.
And you have a brass plate stand. Yeah. It's just a music stand that he was playing with.
It's a music stand.
And you have a violin bow with a horse hair, similar to what he was using.
Yeah, should I do it now, really?
And we will take pictures and post those for our listeners to view, please.
That would be good. Okay, so what we do is we take the sand and we sprinkle it on the brass plate. You can hear the brass plate tinkling here. And we play the brass plate with the violin bow. And here we go.
And that simple gesture produces a very intricate pattern in the sand on the plate.
It's a beautiful pattern on the sand, on the plate. And you can play this plate anywhere on the edge, and where you play the edge with the violin bow, you get a different pattern emerge. So there's a whole range of these kind of archetypal patterns. But you can actually play the plate at more than one place. So whilst the plate is vibrating because you've struck the plate at one particular position, you can then play it at a different position whilst it's still vibrating, and you can get a whole range of patterns, a whole infinity of patterns really occur on this plate. But these patterns are not just pretty patterns, they actually mean something. They have great importance for mankind. But Ernst Chladni, I don't think he really realized what he'd found there. About 50 years later, an Englishman called Michael Faraday, interested in Ernst Chladni's work, he took up this same kind of science, and he explored vibrations on planks of wood, for example. He sprinkled sand on planks of wood and he vibrated them, and again he saw wonderful patterns occurring.
I wouldn't think wood would vibrate like metal would.
Wood is actually very resonant, a very resonant material, especially if you use hardwoods. But the amazing thing about Michael Faraday's work is that he found no applications for this new field that he was working in. So he followed on from Ernst Chladni. He sprinkled sand, in this case, on wooden planks mainly, and observed the patterns, the beautiful patterns that emerged. And he spent 6 months of his life on this, and yet didn't find a single application.
But Faraday was a brilliant scientist who invented the dynamo and the Faraday cage. He made important contributions. So
he made amazing. He made amazing contributions. But for some strange reason, he didn't find any applications for this new field that he was working
in. I bet you put him here today, and he would find like you are.
I think he would. He was just too far ahead of his time.
Or the technology wasn't there for him to.
Maybe. Yeah, I think that has happened to many scientists in history. But going on from there, there was another man, this guy called Hermann Helmholtz, who was another German scientist. This German scientist studied these kind of phenomena, these vibratory phenomena, using laboratory glass jars. And in those days, he couldn't find any kind of membranes to use other than pig's bladders. So he actually stretched a pig's bladder across a laboratory glass jar and again sprinkled sand on and fed in a whole series of different sounds into these glass jars and again observed the phenomena. Now, it was this guy, Hermann Helmholtz, who was the first scientist to actually look into the mathematics of these patterns. So he tried to describe them mathematically, the first man in history to actually do that. Then we move on about another 50 years to round about 1900. This is the story of a woman called Margaret Watts Hughes, and she was a Welsh woman, lived in Wales, in Britain, and she studied this particular same kind of science by stretching an India rubber membrane across a wooden receiver, as she called it, and coming out of this receiver was a long tube into which she either sang or played various musical instruments such as the harmonium.
India rubber was the rubber from the trees, rubber trees.
Yeah, rubber from the trees. And again, you know, it seems to be the problem that all kind of science has found in this particular series of events throughout history. The membrane seems to have been the biggest problem, you know, what to use for a membrane. In this particular instance, she used India rubber. And she again sprinkled sand and other types of powders onto her membrane and sang into this long tube.
Now, and found interesting patterns.
She found beautiful patterns emerging, and one of the interesting things about Margaret Watts Hughes's work is that she was the first woman in history to use these patterns as a kind of music notation. So she set them to music, which was great. So instead of having, you know, the standard musical stave, she was using these cymatic patterns, not known to her as cymatic patterns. Her device was actually called an idophone, so she called these idophone patterns. And from these patterns, she, as I say, she was able to actually show music to a number of people. So that's Margaret Watts Hughes, round about the turn of the century. And then finally, we find this guy, Hans Jenny, who was a Swiss scientist operating around the 1960s. And Hans Jenny really opened up the science in a huge way. He used modern day equipment. He used electronic oscillators. He used crystal resonators. So now we're not using the voice anymore to actually vibrate these membranes. We're actually using electronic apparatus.
And very pure tones.
Very pure tones, yes. I mean, if you use a crystal resonator, you get a superbly pure tone. And you can therefore look at the science from a very pure perspective. You can repeat the experiments again and again, and you can see what results you get. And Hans Jenny spent many, many years studying these phenomena, and he made a huge contribution to science as a result.
I also understand he used many different media, like water droplets, laser refractions on water droplets, and all sorts of mediums to vibrate to see these patterns.
He did. He used all forms of media, powders, pastes, even iron filings. He observed many, many forms of modal phenomena. But his work was mainly concerned with actually observing. He wasn't particularly concerned with any applications. Whereas I'm a really kind of practical guy. You know, I always look for applications in things.
One of the unique contributions that you've also made, John, were, in addition to this new device I want you to describe, your cymoscope, is you've added the dimension of sacred geometry chambers, making a difference, adding a color to this whole process, as well as resonant materials. Mm. Let's talk about those two contributions and what you found in Egypt. That's where you first discovered these were important considerations in this.
Well, the first question regarding the actual geometry, let's say, of these patterns. First of all, I think maybe your listeners should understand that these patterns are beautiful. I mean, they have harmonic structure. They, for all the world, look like a snowflake. You know how snowflakes, there's no two snowflakes look alike. And these patterns are very similar in structure to snowflakes. So they have this kind of beautiful harmony in their proportions and so on. And I thought, well, why has no one ever studied the geometry of these beautiful sound patterns? And so I started to actually do just that. And one day in my laboratory, an amazing thing happened. I was using a very pure tone, very low frequency pure tone, and on the membrane appeared a pentagon shape, a beautiful pentagon shape, which I'd never seen before. And in the center of the pentagon was a circle, just a plain circle. And I was really jumping for joy. You know, I danced around. I wish I could have shared this moment with someone. I was dancing around my laboratory. You know, it was one of these kind of eureka moments. And I shared this with a number of people since, and they said, well, why are you getting so excited about a pentagon in a circle, you know? And the reason I got so excited was because a pentagon contains phi, P-H-I, phi, which is a mathematical constant of the universe. And this mathematical constant here, I was finding it from a very pure sound that I was putting into my apparatus. And for me, this was a momentous moment, but not only phi, but also pi, because, of course, pi is the constant concerned with circles. So here I had two mathematical constants popping out of this membrane, and I went on to find many, many more in the patterns that I was seeing. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit later about patterns from birds and from animals and from all sorts of other sounds. And these mathematical constants keep popping out everywhere in these patterns.
And so when you look at the underlying structures of creation, it's also the underlying structures of life forms.
Absolutely.
And the implications for healing, for medicine, for all of that. Before we get to that, back to Egypt and what you found when you went to Egypt. That was one of your first series of cymatics experiments.
Yes, it was really, it was the first major cymatic experiment that, that I did. So I went back to Egypt in late 97. I gained permission to go into the Great Pyramid to do these experiments. But something happened to me a few weeks before I was due to go out. I actually had a very severe back injury. And from this back injury, I learned so much. You know, at the time I had the back injury, I thought,
"This is annoying."
Yeah, I'm not going to be able to do my work. I really didn't think I could actually do it, because I knew from past injuries that I'd had to my spine that whenever this kind of event occurs, it takes many, many weeks for nature to do the healing. And here I was with two very heavy cases that I had to take into the Great Pyramid. I had to obtain help to do that. You know, someone actually helped me in to the pyramid with the cases, and I only had 3 hours to do this particular experiment. And what this experiment was, essentially, in order to explore the resonances in the 4-ton granite box which lies in the King's Chamber, sits on the floor of the King's Chamber, I decided to use cymatics as a tool to explore those resonances in that box. And in order to do this, I determined that I would stretch a membrane across the open top of the sarcophagus. Now, some of your listeners may know that one corner of this sarcophagus is actually really badly broken away. No one really knows how this happened. Maybe it was people striking the sarcophagus. There's certainly that story going around that in the Victorian era, people used to strike the sarcophagus to make it a beautiful sound. When you strike it, you get this really wonderful, low-pitched, resonant, bell-like sound. So whether it was that or you know, maybe someone in ancient history damaging it, we don't know. But anyway, that corner is badly broken away, and therefore, in order to stretch the membrane across the open top of the sarcophagus, I had to repair the corner. So
at least temporarily.
Yeah, just a temporary repair, and the antiquities people were quite happy with me doing that. I wasn't doing any damage to the sarcophagus. So I repaired the corner with big slabs of expanded polystyrene and gaffer tape and all this sort of thing. And then I stretched this very thin plastic membrane over the top of the sarcophagus, and I weighted it round the perimeter with 43 little bags of sand, and these bags of sand gave it a kind of even torsion. And then I sprinkled sand.
Oh, stretched tight across.
Yeah, stretched tight, like a drum for all the world. Then I sprinkled sand on the membrane itself, and I had put a little loudspeaker in the bottom of the sarcophagus with, you know, which to make sound. And I then turned on my equipment and began making very low pitch sounds to begin with.
And working your way up the frequency
band. But of course, what happened was really quite amazing. Two amazing things happened, really. The first was that when I began to see patterns emerging on the membrane, these patterns weren't anything like I'd ever seen before. These patterns very strongly resembled ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs.
Now, stop and think about that. Here you've got hieroglyphs emerging as a cymatics pattern in this granite box. And this is the same forms that these ancient Egyptians used to construct their language, as a symbol of their language.
Absolutely. I was absolutely astounded.
What's the correlation here? How do you suppose...
It took me a while to figure out this correlation. In fact, initially, it was hard to believe what I was seeing with my own eyes, you know, and the antiquities inspector, who I think up to this point, you know, probably thought, oh, this is a mad Englishman.
Another mad Englishman.
You know, but let him do his research. Anyway, at this point, he got very excited, and he came running over to look at what was appearing on this membrane. And one after the other, these beautiful Egyptian hieroglyphs appeared, and of course, each time this happened, I took a photograph. These were standard photographs. So I really pray that they would ultimately come out. You know, that it would be they wouldn't be corrupted or anything. But they did ultimately come out. So I've now got a photographic record of all these hieroglyphs that appeared on this sarcophagus.
But how many total?
About 20 different hieroglyphs. And then about half an hour into this experiment, I was bending over, adjusting the controls to see yet
another... With that bad back of
with a very, very painful back to see yet another hieroglyph, when suddenly I realized that actually the pain in my back had gone. There was no pain. And this was really a momentous moment, because this was a life-changing moment for me, because I then realized that something very, very important and profound had happened, and it took me a long time to figure out, you know, what had actually happened.
Harmonic sound waves can heal the human body as well?
I didn't know that at the time. In fact, at the time, I really thought that perhaps it was just endorphins, you know, from the excitement of seeing these hieroglyphs.
But your back pain never came back?
It never came back, no.
But we will come back and have more conversation with John Reed. Lots more to discuss on cymatics and his own contributions to this exciting, emerging new field. I'm Laura Lee. I hope you're enjoying the show. And for more information on our guests and topics, you'll find links, books, and source materials at lauralee.com. Just use our search engine to get right where you want to go. And for a list of upcoming shows, as well as special events and exclusive news and updates on our travels around the country, sign up for my newsletter. It's free and delivered by email. It's all at lauralee.com. Stay in touch. Let's continue our conversation with acoustics engineer and cymatics researcher, John Reed. John, so there you were in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid with your cymatics experiment stretched out over the sarcophagus. Mm. They don't know that it actually served as a sarcophagus. You think of it as a big granite box.
Mm.
Here you are getting images of hieroglyphs by running tones through with a membrane stretched across the top, thinking, this is interesting. You say that it had to do with the sacred geometry proportions of both the King's Chamber itself and this granite box.
Mm.
We can talk about sacred geometry and define that. You also suspect that it had to do with the very resonant qualities of the material, the granite.
Mm. Yeah, there are various aspects at work here. The first is that, and these, of course, I didn't realize at the time. I had to figure this out later. But the various things that happened here, first of all, why did the sarcophagus produce hieroglyphs? This is a really interesting question.
The very same forms that became the Egyptian language.
Yeah, absolutely. And the quick answer to that is that the granite box itself produces its own kind of sounds. So what I was putting in these very pure low-frequency sounds initially, then going up to higher and higher frequencies. But nevertheless, every sound that I put in was a very pure sound. But the sarcophagus actually makes its own sound. So when you excite it, it actually sings back to you. It gives back to you something a lot more than what you're putting in, basically. And the reason it does that is because granite contains a very high percentage of quartz. And you probably know that quartz is...
Quartz, back to those radio crystals.
Absolutely. It's a very resonant stone, very resonant material, rather, crystal. And quartz sings to you when you excite it. So that there was a rich sound being given off by this sarcophagus. And these hieroglyphic forms are actually a manifestation of those rich sounds. So in the end, I figured, and of course this is only a hypothesis, it's not yet proven, but I figured that the ancient Egyptians had been subliminally affected by the sounds given off by granite. And I actually made a discovery which almost certainly will turn out to be the key to this whole matter, which is that at a place called Hierakonpolis, which is just south of Luxor in southern Egypt, this is the birthplace of Egyptian civilization. It's also the birthplace of the hieroglyphic language. And Egyptologists believe that around about 3,600 to 3,900 BC is when the hieroglyphic language was first developed. But coincidentally, or maybe it isn't a coincidence, around the same time, the ancient Egyptians were also working granite. So previous to this, they'd worked softer stones.
Limestone,
for example, yeah. And they'd also used wood in the construction of their buildings, their temples, and so on. But here, in this period of time, they started to work with granite, very hard stone. And when you, let's say in the case of a sarcophagus, when you are hollowing out a sarcophagus, it rings like a bell. You get these beautiful, complex sound waves that bathe you. So I figured that the scribes who were responsible for developing this the hieroglyphic language were actually being bathed in these sonic emanations, and therefore being subliminally affected, you know, in order to actually cause them to create certain symbols which resemble the sound patterns that they were actually receiving.
And their philosophy, the ancient Egyptian philosophy, as in so many other ancient societies, indigenous societies today, believe that the whole universe is alive, that the whole universe is conscious, that they are communicating on so many levels with all of creation. So let's just attribute it to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, the whole of the universe is vibrating. Everything vibrates.
Everything's singing.
Everything sings.
And talking to each other.
Yeah, and of course, on that level, the human being is no exception. You know, we are a complex layer upon layer of frequencies. And so, yeah, I mean, it's only a hypothesis at this stage, but I really do believe that it may answer the question how hieroglyphs appeared on that sarcophagus.
But it also may throw a window into what the human being is really about, that we are part and parcel of this web of life, that we receive and communicate on levels even beyond our conscious mind.
Absolutely. And one of the other pieces of evidence that I gathered that actually supports this hypothesis that I have regarding the hieroglyphs is that I was able to work with a man called Bear. He's actually a huge man. He's as big as a bear. And he plays the didgeridoo. And I was able to work with Bear in one particular period of time, just after the work that I did in Egypt, where I was using my device, my cymoscope device, or an early version of it, and to manifest the sounds from Bear's didgeridoo. And when Bear played his didgeridoo into my device, up on the membrane came what Bear said was Aboriginal artwork. Well, I just had to take his word for it. I had never seen Aboriginal artwork before. But if I can just explain briefly what it looks like, it's kind of circles within circles. So you have maybe a circle with little lines, little rays coming out of the perimeter. And then within that outer circle, you have other small areas, some small circles. And I later found out, you know, I bought a book on Aboriginal artwork, and sure enough, these are absolutely Aboriginal icons. You know, these are what the Aboriginals actually painted themselves.
And so the didgeridoo would produce those particular icons that are symbolic of that culture. Mm. I just love the correlation there. We also, my husband Paul and I, got to participate in another such experiment of yours when we went to England a couple years ago.
Mm.
And you set up that experiment in the St. Catherine's Cathedral, St. Catherine's Chapel, very small chapel up on a hill, that was a Templar chapel that was built by the Templars, which was why you chose that particular structure.
It has a wonderful resonance. St. Catherine's Chapel has a wonderful resonance. Maybe not quite as good as the King's Chamber, but certainly up there with, you know, the top five.
Very thick walls, which one of the colleagues of yours thought was equipped inside these big, thick walls with helm holes, resonators. We talked about helm holes earlier. He thought the monks might have made clay pots that they actually buried
in the walls,
to increase its reverberatory qualities.
Mm.
Here it was in sacred geometry proportions once again, because that's why the way the Templars built.
Yes.
Let's talk about Paul, my husband Paul's contribution to this experiment, because he got very beautiful megalithic maze patterns when he played his red cedar Native American flute for you.
Absolutely. Yeah, so what happened here? We set up this cymatic apparatus in St. Catherine's Chapel, and we had a number of people there making sacred sound. And I think your listeners should realize or should know here that the sounds created in any given space actually do significantly affect the pattern that you see on the membrane. So, in other words, a bit like the sarcophagus in the King's Chamber, the object, or in this case the chamber itself, kind of sings to you. Its resonance is important, it's vitally important in the way that these patterns form on the membrane. In fact, if you remember, Laura Lee, at one particular point in that experiment, my apparatus was actually turned off. The electronics was turned off, and only the membrane itself was sitting there with sand sprinkled on it, and sounds were being made in that beautiful chamber, and patterns were forming on the membrane without any electronics at all. So there's a kind of proof, you know, that it is simply the membrane in the space that makes the difference, that actually forms this beautiful pattern. So a number of people made sacred sound with their voices, but also Paul made his sound with his wonderful flute, and some amazing patterns appeared on the surface of the membrane.
What's interesting to me about Paul's contribution to this was he was playing a whole song, very heartfelt, very evocative, a short song. So he was playing many notes, but we were watching on screen as the sand just started to coalesce into these rings, not concentric rings. It was exactly that.
That's kind of spiral shape.
Maze pattern.
Yeah.
But it looked like that maze that shows up elsewhere in the UK.
Yeah.
All over the place.
The very, very many megalithic monuments where you see these kind of swirls, these spiral swirls. So I was fascinated to see that, you know, form on a membrane in a Templar chapel. It is amazing actually to watch these things actually forming.
Like a very ancient pattern that was coming forth, wasn't it?
Yes, and yeah. There may well be an explanation yet to come as to why the ancient peoples used that particular form, that spiral form. You know, it's one tool that we have to explore these ancient icons that these people created, and there's no one has any knowledge at the moment as to why these spirals were placed on these megalithic monuments. And here, maybe,
where they conjured up these particular patterns over and over again.
Maybe we have a tool here that we can use to explore megalithic monuments in the future. Take these cymatic apparatus into megalithic monuments and actually make sound in them, and perhaps find out why these particular icons were produced in this way.
One has to ask the question at this stage, John, because you have three examples of iconic symbolic artwork showing up in the cymatic patterns in those very locales.
Mm.
Aboriginal, Egyptian, and megalithic British Isles. If the people themselves, way back then, were able to put together a cymatics experiment of their own,
yes,
with the materials they had at hand. For example, you've also discovered that there was an African tribe. I know you're still looking for which tribe this is, but you read somewhere that an African tribe, as one of their methods of divination, which is communicating with the mysteries, would sprinkle sand on a drum head and then chant,
yes,
and watch for patterns to emerge that would be significant and speak to them.
Mm.
So one wonders, in addition to picking it up subconsciously and reflecting back what that earth location itself is saying to you.
I mean, could they have actually done this
experiment
themselves?
Could they have made it visible in similar fashion,
well,
as you're doing today, but with primitive materials?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they certainly had all the materials at their disposal. Yeah, I mean, certainly animal skins could have been used as membranes, for example. Remember earlier I said about Hermann Helmholtz, who used pig's bladders, for example. So, yeah, I mean, they had everything available. I mean, the ancient Egyptians, for example, could have done the same experiment, essentially, that I did. Instead of a loudspeaker, they would have actually lain in the sarcophagus.
And had somebody with a good voice.
Yeah, somebody with a good voice, and they would have simply toned in the sarcophagus.
And they could have stretched a big skin over
the ancient Egyptians had a ceremony called the opening of the mouth ceremony, and part of that ceremony involved a tekenu, the Shem priest, being dragged into the chamber on a sledge. And he was in the fetal position, and he was traditionally he was covered in the skin of a sacred bull. So here they had, actually in the king's chamber, we believe anyway, a sacred bull skin. So they had that, they could have stretched that over the sarcophagus. They certainly had plenty of sand outside the pyramid. So, you know, they had all the components, all the elements were there. They could have done that experiment, sure. And of course, the same is true of the ancient monuments in Britain. You know, you have the megalithic monuments, which many of which are highly, highly resonant inside. So yes, all these people could have performed these kind of experiments. That, of course, is highly speculative, Laura Lee. I mean, I really don't...
But we have to ask the question, could it have been done? Not was it done, but
well, okay.
Could it have been done? And
yes,
here's another example. Yes. When Paul and I were exploring the American Southwest and went into a recreated kiva, quite a large one, there were two square troughs on either side of the ceremonial center.
Mm-hmm.
And we were asking the curator, what was this about? What were these used for? And she said, well, one of the theories is that these were stretched over with skins and they were actually drums.
Oh, wow.
And so right there where there'd be dancing, which could set up vibrations.
Yes.
And they could have sprinkled sand or similar over. You could set up where there would be pattern, even glasses of water, even if you'd put water in there.
That's so interesting, because
you could see vibratory patterns from feet stomping, instruments playing, chanting.
Well, you mentioned this about the African tribe, which I'm on the track of at the moment, trying to find this African tribe.
So if anyone has any information, please email us and let us know, but go ahead.
Yeah, this is actually, this tribe is mentioned in an atlas of religion, and I'm on the track of it at the moment. I really hope that I do track them down. But they are deliberately sprinkling sand on a drum head to divine future events. But what you're saying here is very interesting, because it kind of fits in with the way that I view this situation. These very ancient peoples may well have seen accidentally patterns emerging on a drum head, because the drum is a very, very ancient instrument. Certainly from my knowledge of ancient Egyptian history,
would have been one of the first long flute, actually.
Around about 3700 BC is the first evidence that we have of the drum, and so it is a very old instrument. And I believe that even if a drum head was just lying in a chamber on the floor, somebody kicked some sand on it, you know, accidentally even, then because of what I was telling you about St. Catherine's Chapel, how, you know, patterns will form on the surface just by being in that resonant space, that it seems almost inconceivable in a way that these kind of things didn't happen in history.
And had they been observed, it would have looked like the God speaking to them for
yes.
patterns to suddenly emerge.
It would have appeared
that
like
were beautiful
magic.
And orderly. Yeah, yeah, and that would have been highly significant, and they would have said, oh, the universe is speaking to us, let's take this pattern, this means something, this is important, and run with it, I would think.
And certainly, you know, as far as the Aboriginals are concerned, we're talking earlier about the Aboriginals, maybe that's how they ended up seeing these particular patterns, and that's why we now see the Aboriginal artwork. But that same guy, by the way, I forgot to mention, when we did the experiment with Bear, we also went on to look at the sound patterns from two other instruments, not just the didgeridoo, but the two other instruments were a Celtic horn, and in the case of a Celtic horn, it's a kind of thing about 18 inches across, and it's got a big bend in it, a bit like a cow's horn, but it's made of metal. And when he played that, what we got up on the screen, on the membrane...
A Celtic symbol?
A Celtic symbol, exactly. We got Celtic knotwork. And everyone knew that,
wow.
You know, at the time. And it really spaced us out when we saw that. And then he had this amazing instrument about 15 feet long, this Tibetan horn which he screwed together. And then he played this really low-pitched sound through it. And what came on the membrane was a beautiful Tibetan mandala. So, you know, it isn't just the isolated case of the hieroglyphs on the membrane in the king's chamber.
This is showing up all over.
There is a definite correlation between the iconography of these ancient cultures and the musical instruments which they were actually using or had invented.
This is exciting. This is profound. This means something, John.
Well, I think it means a really big link into the birth of language, actually, almost. Certainly written language and art. That's right.
Because these are enduring symbols that have stood the test of time, that look so right in those locales with those cultures, too.
Absolutely. And I want to continue this line of research. One area I want to look at, for example, are Japanese drums. I went to see a wonderful presentation of Japanese drums a while ago, and it occurred to me that maybe these drums were giving out, you know, really interesting sound patterns. And I've come across a book on Japanese artwork, and in it are some patterns which strongly resemble cymatic patterns that I've already seen coming from low frequencies.
Oh, exciting.
So it is really exciting work, and that's something I'm going to be doing next year.
What are the implications here, then, for cymatics? As this, I mean, if you were sitting on a research fund and you could hire various scientists and say, go research this, go research this, here are the tools to do this, what sort of projects would you set up? Where would you go with this? Let's start with the healing of your back, first of all, because sound therapy is used in hospitals to break up kidney stones, for example.
Yes.
What else could it do? What is it doing aligning you with harmonic patterns, putting you back to rights? What do you think is going on there?
There's a whole stack of applications, actually, that come from cymatics. The first one is learning about how life actually began on our planet.
You have another interesting hypothesis on this.
I do. Most scientists would not disagree that life began in the primordial oceans. But no one really knows how it was that all the building blocks of life assembled. How did they come together? You know, what was the divine spark that brought all these building blocks together? And what I believe, it was, in a sense, it was the voice of God. But not in a religious sense. You know, I'm not talking religion here. I'm talking
This is the vibratory universe.
The vibratory universe.
That works in harmonics and resonance.
Absolutely. So in my hypothesis, what actually happens is that sound from above the ocean, this is the wave action, this white noise, this wonderful white noise that you hear when you walk
by the sea. Because it's a rhythmic beat. The waves.
Not just because it's a rhythmic beat, it's also full of all sound. So when you see the white waves crashing, they're also full of what, in acoustic speak, we call white noise, which is full spectrum sound. It's basically all sounds mixed in together, right from the very low frequencies, right away up into frequencies we can't even hear.
Maybe that's why it's so soothing for us to listen to it.
Yeah, well, I think it's so soothing because we actually came from the oceans in the very early days of the Earth. So in this hypothesis, the sounds from above the ocean actually impinge upon the ocean depths, and in so doing they are filtered. The sounds are actually filtered by the water itself. So anyone who's ever stuck their head under the water and listened to ocean sounds will know that all the high frequencies are first filtered out. So as you put your head under the water, first of all, the high frequencies are filtered, then the mid-range frequencies as you go a little bit deeper, until when you get to great depth, all you're actually left with is a very, very pure, low-frequency sound. Now, what your listeners need to understand is that these kind of sounds, these really low-frequency sounds, have beautiful structure. They're not just sounds, they're actually structure. And when you look at the structure of those sounds, you see that it's microscopic in its structure. It goes right away down to submicroscopic, actually, forms.
What you found in your laboratory? You've done experiments.
I found all these kind of things in my laboratory. And the hypothesis goes that these sounds from above the ocean that end up as these really pure sine wave sounds at great depth. Remember I was saying earlier about how I found the Pentagon just by creating a pure sine wave sound in my laboratory.
Photonic solid showing up there,
So this is why that when you look at life today and you analyze life in its proportions, you will find phi, this golden mean, the same mathematical ratio is embedded in every living creature. And the reason for it is because we actually started in the primordial oceans with a sound. It was a sound that actually brought the components of life together.
So there we can find a correlate between the forms of life, mathematical ratios, and phi, which you dissect any form, living form, and you find the phi ratio,
you
the golden mean ratio.
Phi ratio in
it wasn't just the
form.
Greeks designing in the golden mean ratio
no.
because they thought it was beautiful and harmonious. It was actually
it is that,
akin to, it is that, but not just that. It is the very form in which nature produces life forms.
Absolutely. You know, it runs
it's
throughout.
It's the formula that
yes.
runs through everything.
Exactly. It's the divine formula that actually occurred in those primordial oceans. So that's one direction for actually seeing how life formed in the primordial oceans.
And when you look at Templar structures or ancient Egyptian structures or any structures that built along sacred geometry proportions, you would get more profound effects because you're that much closer to umping up the signal,
well, you,
making
you,
it coherent.
You create
it
the very vibratory phenomena which really created life in the first instance. So yes, that's it's
so that would make sense.
It's no wonder that we have these kind of profound.
So maybe one of the implications is perhaps architecture should pay attention and we should be building along sacred geometry
sure,
proportions,
absolutely.
Not just for the aesthetics but for some other profound deep reasons.
Absolutely. But there are many other applications, certainly for sound healing. We are using ultrasound today in hospital environments for healing of tissue, even though the underlying mechanisms are not fully understood. But I had an amazing healing in the Great Pyramid. My back was healed after only about 30 minutes of doing my work in the Great Pyramid. And I went on to actually discover what I believe to be the mechanism for that healing. And so here's yet another application. And the mechanism is actually really simple, as most things usually are, you know, that are so profound. And the simplicity comes from simply bathing cells or sensitizing cells with electrostatic charge and then going on to bathe them in ultrasound. So you first sensitize the tissues electrostatically.
Making it receptive.
Yeah, making it receptive effectively. And then you go on to actually bathe it in ultrasound. And there's a company in Ireland that's actually doing this very research. And I found from my own work in the Great Pyramid corroboration, because here when the...
You were the experiment.
I was the experiment in a sense, because when the quartz crystals in the sarcophagus were excited, they gave off electrostatic charge, which was obviously bathing my body, and then of course the wonderful sounds I was making in there were also bathing my body, and so I was healed.
So we can imagine chambers in the future where you could walk into, get electrostatic, and then maybe they analyze your frequencies to see which one is the most healing for you.
I've actually designed such chambers.
I've already
designed those chambers.
I have to visit your laboratory.
And I really believe that in the future that we will have chambers where people walk in to be healed, and they will lie down and they will be bathed in electrostatics and all sound, all ultrasound frequencies, and they will be healed.
Well, we already know that the Mozart effect, for example, promotes learning, so there must be environments in which we can promote some of the better qualities of our being. And for gardens growing, I understand, so people give sounds to make their plants grow better. I mean, this has immense applications.
Oh, there's huge applications. But one of the other important applications is for helping deaf people to speak and helping stroke victims.
How would that work?
Well, because sound has structure, sound has form, and the speech therapist in this case would simply speak into a microphone, and the sounds that she's making, whether they be simple words or even just simple sounds, are actually manifest on the membrane as a picture, as a visual picture. And as you know, the visual cortex of the brain is so much more powerful than the auditory.
More well-developed.
More well-developed, absolutely. And therefore, the patient, whether it be stroke victim or person that, you know, has lost their speech for some other reason, or someone who was born deaf, will be able to see those patterns form. And all they have to do is to try to copy those patterns. And in so doing, they know that they're making the right sounds.
Because let's not forget, what this is about is making sound waves visible.
Making it manifest, exactly. So I think it's a really powerful tool that will help humankind in so many different ways in the future. And I feel so privileged that, you know, that I'm part of this whole process.
You're the next in this long line of scientists that have been working in this field, John. And we haven't even gotten to your cymoscope. We're out of time. But there are many devices that will help us see sound, help us see these sound patterns that underlie creation, that are beautiful and intricate, not just lovely to look at, but mean something very profound here about the way the universe works and the way that we work in it.
And cymatics is a wonderful way, a wonderful portal, a doorway that we can enter to see this new aspect of creation.
Well, no wonder you've made it your life's work. Congratulations on all that you've done. I look forward to hearing about the future, and thank you for sharing this with us here today.
Thank you, Laura Lee.
That was John Reed, again, acoustics engineer, cymatics researcher. Thank you for listening. Looks like there's an exciting road ahead for us in terms of new discoveries and how to apply them. I'm Laura Lee. And again, thanks to our guests today and all of our guests over the years. I'd like to thank my partner in this show and in life, Paul Robert, and for his flute music. And most importantly, thank you for listening. Our mission here is to make our journey through life more entertaining, insightful, and joyful. I hope we've accomplished that here today. And if today's conversation has inspired you to delve further into this arena, you'll find all the resources to get you started at lauralee.com.